Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Noah Beta Haran. I rehearsed the last name, I screw up the first name. Wouldn't you know it? Stay tuned. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There is, by now, a definite formula to Pixar films. It's a formula not necessarily restricted to Pixar films, and it should not be a surprise to anybody, myself included, that there is a recognizable formula. Where Pixar has shown its strength, and this applies to most Pixar films, is that their skills as storytellers and animators manage to keep you engaged, even when you know the formula is in effect. Inside Out, Monsters, Inc., Wall-E, all adhere to that formula, but are works of genius. Yes, I said it, nevertheless. The best moment in Finding Dory is a formula moment. There's probably a more official name for it, but I'm calling it the all-is-lost moment. That moment when our protagonist is at the most dire point in his or her adventures, physically, strategically, and emotionally. In the case of Finding Dory, our heroine, Dory, the fish who suffers from short-term memory loss, whom we first met in Finding Nemo and who is voiced again by Ellen DeGeneres, has been swept away from her companions and finds herself completely isolated. She has no idea where she is, dependent on her friends to keep her on mission, which in this case is to find her parents. She is tortured by a notion of a quest that is not yet completed, but whose full parameters remain frustratingly elusive to her. Confused and frightened, she searches her environment, seeking out anything that will trigger the slightest spark of a memory. Director Andrew Stanton, working with co-director Angus MacLean, drops his camera way back to frame Dory in a great expanse of sea and sucks practically all color out of the scene save for Dory's distinctive blue and yellow markings. It's a quiet yet powerful moment that capitalizes on great production design, camera work, and character animation combined with an affecting voice performance by DeGeneres. Formula maybe, but fantastic formula nevertheless. If only the rest of the film was as exquisitely orchestrated. As strong as the formula works for Finding Dory in that one sequence, it fails the film elsewhere. You get the sense that director Stanton is trying to reach the same emotional beats that he explored far more effectively in Finding Nemo, but they feel more token than genuinely felt. Instead of a dentist's aquarium, here Dory and companions find themselves struggling through a SeaWorld-like marine institute. And while Stanton admirably tells a story that doesn't have any overt bad guys, one wonders if Disney, mindful that the theme park arm has a few nature-based attractions of its own, told Stanton, "Go a little easy on the Free Willy aspect, okay?" The logistics of the adventure feel strained. Turns out fish can actually speak and read English. Big surprise. And a pairing between Dory and a monomaniacal octopus, or septopus since he's lost one tentacle, voiced by Ed O'Neill, doesn't quite click in the way other bristly Pixar friendships do. Not the least, the relationship between Dory and Albert Brooks's neurotic clownfish Marlin in the original Finding Nemo. Not surprisingly, there's lots of beautiful stuff in Finding Dory, including a sweeping shot of the interior of one of the park's attractions with an amazing, gigantic cylindrical aquarium. But this is another Pixar sequel that never manages to justify its existence. From the director who took significant narrative and thematic risks with Wall-E, and whose original Finding Nemo was all about the need to take risks, Finding Dory is, sadly, a conventional Pixar sequel. So, instead, let me perk you up with some good news, if a little off-topic. This Sunday night, / Monday morning, June 26th, / 27th, at midnight, you can catch the official launch of the Monster Channel. 24/7 scary movies, TV shows, music videos, all that stuff delivered direct to your home screens. I'm involved. If you tune in at midnight on Sunday, the launch will kick off with something I created for the station and I'm very proud of, and I'm participating behind the scenes on the retro movie show Throwback Thursdays featuring Fangoria editor emeritus Tony Timponi, and my CFQ TV movie news updates will be running throughout the programming schedule. I don't know when, you'll just have to look for them. You can watch by going to monsterchannel.tv on your PC or iOS device, or by signing up to the Monster Channel app on your Roku device. You can't get it on Android devices yet. Sorry, I hope they're working on that. But no subscription fee. It's all free, as God intended TV networks to be, and all scary, or at least morbidly amusing. We go there too. I'm very excited this is happening. Been a long time coming, and it's going to be fun. The Monster Channel at monsterchannel.tv or on your Roku device. Come scream with us. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
Well, I was hoping to have the song by the Bonzo Doodog Dog Band, and I know that Dan would have appreciated it, playing their song, Look Out, There's a Monster Coming, which would have been so appropriate. So, Dan, you're going to have to promote your self-indulgent little Roku channel. And, you know, I'll forgive you for the fact that it's on iOS and not Android for the moment. But I have a Roku, so that will have to do. And you have to do that next week before I get preempted by more pitching again. Except they may preempt the preemptions because they just figured out that they'd be fundraising during the national election campaigns or caucuses or blood battles or whatever they're called. And, you know, how could we have any programming 24/7 that, you know, that isn't, you know, about what every other radio station is doing at the moment, which is why you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, alternative radio in New York City, WBAI. At 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. You say, okay, there goes, like, I'm telling Noah, my guest this morning, that I've spent time as a professional announcer. And after 40-plus years of doing this, I guess the only thing one can say to that is, well, that wasn't enough now, was it? So say good morning, Noah.
Good morning.
Yeah, do that a few times. Talk to me a little bit. I have to figure out what mic is.
Good morning. Good morning. We talked the whole day through.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning to you. But here's the question.
I cannot tap dance like Donald O'Connor.
No. Oh, you see, yeah. Sorry, you failed the test.
Oh.
Who did that song in the movies? And if you're going to say Debbie Reynolds, Donald O'Connor, or Gene Kelly, I'll say... That was the second or third time.
Oh, you mean from, there was a
Babes,
Broadway melody?
Babes on
say.
Broadway.
Yeah.
I think. It's Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney is the answer to the pop question.
I know.
It's not from...
I know Singing in the Rain came from, like, I want to say Broadway melody or some
it's,
other...
It's actually from
it's
the Hollywood...
And...
No. That came out the same year.
Really?
No,
good
with Charles
Lord.
King and Bessie Love. Not that I know anything about this. But, no, that one is the Broadway melody.
Right.
Which is such a weird movie.
Oh, it's not a very good movie.
The moral of the story is, yes, three ways are fun. That's it. If you watch it, you know, it's this guy and two sisters, and they end up all happy together.
Oh, that's awesome.
I made it through
probably 25 minutes to a half hour before I said, like, this movie just does not interest me. I like old classics. I work in a nursing home. I like old classic movies, old classic songs. The Broadway melody was old, but not a classic.
There are three ways to do movies like that.
Oh, yeah.
Number one, and these are both 1929 movies, by the way. So this is like, you know, right out of... all talking, all dancing, all singing. The method number one is go to YouTube and type in songs from Broadway melody, and you'll only get the musical numbers.
Okay.
Number two is to record it off of Turner Classic Movies, which is the most likely place you will find such a thing, and then fast forward.
Right.
If they look like they're singing, watch it. And then move on. And actually, that's the most fun way, because you get to see all the pre-code costumes or lack thereof.
Oh, yeah.
And on everybody. I was watching one, in fact, two nights ago, where it's like the guys were...
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, at the time, yes, they used the word gay at that time. It certainly looked like they were enjoying each other's company. It was quite something, actually.
Good for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was talking about this 2 weeks ago when Roz Kaveny was on the program.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a trans person.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the derivation of gay. And she told me something that comes from the 1890s.
Oh, the gay 90s.
Yes, they were, but this is actually not related. It simply meant
that somebody... What song do I know from the gay 90s? I want to say Sweet Rosie O'Grady or something like that.
That's probably so.
I'm sorry, I did not mean...
Well, we know all these songs from Bugs Bunny cartoons, right? Because that's where I learned most of my initial music.
Well, that's certainly where I learned Wagner.
Yes, absolutely. Yosemite Sam is Ride of the Valkyries,
yes,
on the top of the ship. You know, never mind the Chuck Jones version in 1951 of What's Opera Doc.
Right.
Long before that, Carl Stalling was throwing in all that stuff. Not that long before, because Yosemite Sam didn't even appear until the very late
40s. Oh, is that so?
Yeah, I know way too much about this stuff. But hey, I've had the opportunity to interview Bob Clampett and Chuck Jones. So.
Hey, that's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Well,
all right.
You know, you don't get paid for working at WBAI. That's the payment.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
It's, you know, either engineering people and watching them come in and out of these hallowed, non-soundproofed halls, or like that. Anyway... So the three ways to watch those movies is, number one,
to YouTube it.
YouTube it.
Only see the musical numbers.
Fast forward through it, or through an altered condition, an altered state of mind.
That would probably do it, too.
Yeah. And only the less legal ones are better than the alcoholic ones.
Yeah, so I imagine the alcoholic ones you... Probably just laugh for a little bit and then go to sleep.
Not even you. Just turn it off.
Well, yeah.
Saying that really sucked. The other one, the one that's singing, that has the big Singing in the Rain number, and they do it about six times in different versions with, like, Marie Dressler with Polly Moran. Cliff Edwards is the one who introduces it, of course. Ukulele Ike, a.k.a. Jiminy Cricket, which is how most people would actually remember him. And people can YouTube Ukulele Ike and Singing in the Rain and see that. It's quite surreal. And then the closing, I think it's the Hollywood Review of 1929. It's a very surrealistic movie, and one that it takes, by the way, let me say to all you correct thinking people out there, deal with the minstrel parts. I'm all in favor of people watching this stuff as long as you are given the historic context and the disclaimer to understand that what we now understand to be racist was simply the background buzz of society in that era.
No kidding. I have had residents where I work say to me, in school we used to put on minstrel shows. And I go, oh, boy.
Yeah, but very often, when I was a kid and becoming cognizant in the late 50s, early 60s, there were so-called minstrel shows. They were white.
Oh, yeah.
And there
you
was...
would just call it a minstrel show because it's a musical
show. And one of the great folk groups that I listened to, well, I thought they were great at the time. I don't know if I'd listen to them today if I'd agree. Were the New Christy Minstrels. Mm. Now, there was a group called the Christy Minstrels. And, they went all the way with the interlocutor and all the worst of it.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that there's great stuff to be found in there, which is why I am waiting. Everybody else in the world is waiting to see Hamilton. Not I. I'm waiting to see Shuffle Along.
Shuffle Along.
Which is on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
Starring, oh, God. Oh, Savin Glover is a choreographer. George C. Wolfe is directing
it. I've seen Savin Glover. He's excellent.
Oh, yes. He's the choreographer, and he's going to be in it. He hasn't been in it yet, but he's going to be in it in October, which is when I have my tickets.
Oh, wow.
And the star of the show, the prima donna, why can't I think of her name? One of the great talents of the latter 20th century and the early 21st century. She only has like 3 or 4 Tony Awards, and she sings opera. Yeah.
Okay.
She does, at any rate, what it is it's Shuffle Along was a show written by Noble Sissel.
Okay.
And the famous one, Earl. My mind is, now that I'm on the air, my mind has just gone black. But blank. Jesus. He wrote I'm Just Wild About Harry. Actually, that song's from the show, I'm Just Wild About Harry, and all that. It was the first major black show on Broadway.
Really?
I thought that
was Porgy and Bess, or however that's
pronounced. Well, that would be about 20 years later.
Yeah.
We're talking about a show that was on just post World War I.
Yeah.
Porgy and Bess is the 30s.
Right. Yeah.
Late 20s. So it's about 15 years later. And it's very likely that Gershwin was seeing...
Oh, yeah.
Seeing this show. Why am I blanking this guy's name? I watched him play Ragtime. He died elderly and great. Let me switch to the computer that's online as opposed to the one through which we play music and call up a browser here and shuffle along. Anyway, because the show Shuffle Along is filled with, you know, the racist background of the time and the self-awareness that this was the only black musical of its era, and there were certain expectations that the audiences, the predominantly white audiences, would have. I don't want to buy tickets. Thank you. Let's just go to Wikipedia. So he wrote, the whole show is Shuffle Along, or how it found, you know, how black theater found its way onto Broadway in this era. So he wrote a backstory about the making of, including
that's very the thing. Interesting.
And it's fascinating stuff. And it would be the best Broadway musical of the year. No question what, except for one little thing.
Uh-oh.
Hamilton.
Well, I can't complain. I haven't actually heard Hamilton yet. You know, it's one of those things everybody has bought the...
Ubi Blake was the guy, the composer.
Oh, Ubi Blake. Okay, I've heard of Hamilton.
It's written, Ubi Blake wrote it. It was redone. The show launched the careers of, among other people, Josephine Baker and Paul Robeson.
Wow.
It's 1921. The Broadway adaptation is Shuffle Along, or The Making of a Musical Sensation of 1921 and All That Followed.
Hmm.
So George Wolfe, who wrote and directed, tried to get it posted as revival, except that it's got too much original book explaining the racism in the era in which it was done.
Yeah.
And also the personal lives of the people who were actually in the original show.
Hmm.
So, now why?
Well, just tell everybody who's in line ahead of you to see Shuffle Along, that well, somebody's selling Hamilton tickets around the corner and then cut the line.
No, I've got my tickets to Shuffle Along.
Oh, okay. You're just waiting.
Well, yes, because the star of the show, darn it, why is this not giving me the stars of, thank you, Audra McDonald.
Audra McDonald.
Okay. Audra McDonald.
Audra McDonald.
Yes, A-U-D-R-A. Well, you're not a New Yorker.
It's true. So I am not a New Yorker.
She does not do movies.
I drove down here from Waltham, Massachusetts this very evening.
The heart of half of the tech startups.
Yep.
Not startups, but the now accomplished. They're mostly
home of such prestigious institutions as Brandeis University,
right,
and Bentley University, and me.
There you go. Yeah, and not too far from ReaderCon, which is
not
about 3 weeks.
Terribly far from ReaderCon.
You're going to be attending,
although it's moved from Burlington to Quincy, which
Quincy,
is unfortunate.
No, but, it isn't.
Well, it's unfortunate for me because it's more traffic to get from Waltham to Quincy than from Waltham to Burlington.
Listen, if you're coming from New York.
Well, that's true.
And I just didn't care for the hotel in Burlington.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. My favorite one was in Framingham.
Oh, okay.
When it was in Framingham.
Framingham. That would have been so convenient for me.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Framingham, the hotel wanted us.
Oh,
I wanted to record William Gibson. Uh-huh. Was reading a story, the William Gibson of Neuromancer and all that. And he was reading a story somewhere, and I needed a microphone stand. I had my mic, I had my equipment and all that. It wasn't this little portable thing that I've got today.
Right.
And somebody in the hotel saw what I was doing and just went and got all the equipment and set
amazing.
Me up. And, you know, it's like, if you ask like that, you know, the first question would be, A, are you union?
Right.
B, is the person who's going to fetch it for you a member of the correct union?
Right.
And C, this is what we're going to charge.
Yeah.
And besides that, they remodeled the hotel in Burlington where the convention has been for about the last 10 years. The pub is gone, replaced by some corporate...
Yeah.
DJ dance hall.
You see, I haven't been there a terribly long time. This will be, I want to say, my third ReaderCon. Because I haven't been a very active member of the sci-fi fantasy community.
What do you call the fanish community?
Exactly. When it comes down to it, I've never been much of a fan, even though I've watched shows, I've read books, I've...
You've written one.
And now I've written one, but...
Called Silent Hall.
Called Silent Hall, which
published
I really ought
by...
to be... I ought to be plugging them. Silent Hall, published by Angry Robot Books, under my pen name of N.S. Dolkart.
Spelled D-O-L-K-A-R-T.
That is correct. D-O-L-K-A-R-T. It is available everywhere. Go and buy it. And in fact,
wait till the show's over.
Yes,
or Google.
Well, you know, if you want to buy it direct from the publisher on a DRM-free ebook, then you can do that from their website. I believe.
I am always in favor of buying direct.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Plus, that way, I get a slightly larger cut, so you'll be.
As does the publisher.
Exactly. And you don't pay a middleman like Amazon. So
yeah. Or middle woman, you know, it's not Jeff you know. Bezos, you know.
Yeah. where was I? Yes,
no,
I've written a novel.
We have to plug your book.
It's true. We have to plug my book. But I've never really been part of the fanish community because although I've always loved fantasy and sci-fi, and particularly fantasy,
And particularly
Sword and Sorcery, and although I go for epic, but I grew up reading Diana Wynne Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I've read maybe not everything she wrote, but pretty close to it.
Did you like the movie?
Of Howl's Moving Castle?
Mm.
I mean, I didn't like it as a Howl's Moving Castle, but it was perfectly good Miyazaki.
Well, you see, to me, okay, and this is where people are going to, like, slap me.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to say, well, that's faint praise.
I mean, I love Miyazaki, and I will say Hayao Miyazaki movies, especially Ponyo, Kiki's Delivery Service, My Neighbor Totoro, they are the best children's movies you can ever show.
Okay,
a small child.
I'm willing to believe that because that's not what people push. They push Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away.
Hey, you know, I loved Spirited Away.
I
think I enjoyed Princess Mononoke, if I remember which one that is correctly. But
it's the ecological one.
So I have seen it. That was all right. And you know, it was interesting.
And
to
he
me.
Made some miserable movies like Wizard of Earthsea.
Oh, I didn't even see his version of Wizard of Earthsea.
Nobody did, and that's
I
a good thing.
Shouldn't.
That was the second bad version.
Yeah, but you know, Ponyo and Kiki's Delivery Service and My Neighbor Totoro. The thing about them, and I'm sure with a few others too, which because I haven't seen his entire works. The thing about them is that they don't bring all the weird cultural stuff that Disney movies do. You know, I had other parents recommend How to Tame Your Dragon to me, and everyone said, oh, that's a great, you know, movie for kids and whatever. And we started to show it at the time my daughter was two. She's now 3.5. And we started to watch it. To sort of pre-watch it, I think, before showing it to her.
It's not
and
appropriate
like,
for...
instantly, within like 5 minutes...
She'd be bawling.
Well, no, not just that, but within like 5 minutes, there's this totally unnecessary love interest thing going on, and it's like, you know...
What comes a little closer
to,
and
I'm
is still
this to
Disney
kids,
is Brave.
Know, yeah, I've,
Brave
I've heard
is a little
very
closer.
Good things about Brave.
Yeah, but she's, you know, wait till she's like 4 or 5.
Yeah, and the thing is that so many Disney
but
movies, you know, they assume the cultural things that exist in our cultural background. They assume there has to be a love interest or it's not a story. They assume the parents have to be dead or it's not an adventure.
Well,
so on and so forth. You know, now and then you'll get you know, one where one parent is alive. Oh, great. You know, Finding Nemo has one living parent.
Okay,
you know?
But I will defend that. I will not often defend Disney, although I will defend Pixar.
Yeah.
And I am a fan of the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay.
But I consider that junk food.
Yeah.
But some of it's really good junk food, especially when it's done by Joss Whedon. But because he knows how to make junk food.
Yeah, that he does.
And so, you know, there's an exception.
Although I will say I really enjoyed, totally digressing here, I did enjoy Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, wasn't that fun?
It was really fun.
Even though that was watered down 90 minutes, how can you do Shakespeare?
But you know what? It was fun.
And Amy Acker is always amazing.
And it is just such a thing, like... small budget, there should be more small budget movies like that where someone's just like, hey, you know what, let's I'm rich, let's use my fancy house and get a bunch of my actor friends together
as long as we're
and
on
do
strike
some Shakespeare
because that's
yeah I know
they were on strike yeah.
You know, so he did that and Dr. Horrible, but you know, let's get together and do some Shakespeare. And it's like, you know, and it's actually, for all that it's 90 minutes, it is really well done.
Have
and
Nathan it, will film.
Yeah, exactly.
Have Fillion
you know,
will film.
Yeah, Nathan Fillion does a great bit part there. He is,
or have
you know,
Neil will Fillion. There we go.
Yeah, but the whole thing was just delightful.
Yeah.
Okay, now that
but
I've...
But getting back to...
Now that I've put in more of a plug for Much Ado About Nothing.
The Disneyfication. Yeah. The thing about that is it's not – okay, first of all, what Disney has wrought on fairy tales, mm-hmm. or rather household tales,
yes.
which is more to the point,
yeah.
Is generally awful. But having said that, in the defense, the orphan thing is something that goes back to the 17th century.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
The telling of these tales, whether we're talking about Perrault or the Brothers Grimm.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I don't mean to imply in any way that Disney invented the orphan. What I'm saying is that, Disney brings with it all of those cultural assumptions of the 17th century, 18th century, etc., the necessity for the orphanage for the orphan to start the story. Whereas Hayao Miyazaki and I think he does a lot of adaptation, so he's not, you know, entirely making this up himself, but the way he adapts stories and the stories he chooses to adapt do not come with those same cultural assumptions. You know, in Ponyo, both parents are alive for both of the
and
main characters.
Away.
For Spirited Away, there's at least, well, with Spirited Away, the parents are in danger because they turn into pigs, and there's the whole thing with there. But you know, with the amazing one, really, is Kiki's Delivery Service, where both the parents are alive, they're together, they're happy. And there's just a rule that the kid has to go off and do her thing and be an apprentice witch without her parents and have adventures. And the end of the movie is her writing a letter to her parents saying things are great, you know. And that's the kind of thing that we don't get in Disney movies, because there's this this legacy of the fairy tale thing that does not allow children to have adventures without a very dark backdrop of, why are they on their own without a chaperone?
You're not wrong to pick on Disney, but that's true in most American culture. Think comic books.
Oh, yeah.
Clark Kent starts.
Right.
As an orphan when he's a baby.
Right.
And then he's orphaned again.
Yeah.
Then Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And all of these characters.
But those
Wonder Woman, actually, she has her mother at least.
Yeah. What I will say, though, is that those characters are not generally marketed, or at least were not originally marketed to the, like, 5 and under crowd.
No, they were not.
So while I'm, you know, how many of us were traumatized by Bambi? I don't mean to imply that I'm against the use of the orphan trope in general in fantasy and science fiction and whatever superhero falls into, which really ought to be more fantasy than sci-fi, but for some reason is grouped with sci-fi instead. In any case, I'm not against the use of that trope. It has a long legacy and all of that, and it can be, you know.
Yeah, but what would you say, for example, about a book?
But I wouldn't turn to somebody and say, you know what would be really great for your child, who's like 4, is this story that starts with, you know, both parents dying and an entire planet being destroyed in a planet-wide calamity.
Well, the fact of this matter is that it's not always the stories that are the problem, but the marketing.
Right.
Okay. And Disney is marketing more than anything else. And they can do very good movies. I was shocked at when they took the ultimate anti-Disney story, which is Into the Woods.
Hmm.
Which is by Sondheim and James Lapine,
right,
based on Bruno Bettelheim, this Freudian interpretation, which is very anti-Disney, again,
right.
not opposed to, but different from.
Yes.
And Disney made the movie.
Right.
And
because it was already a hit musical.
well, because they got Rob Marshall,
yeah,
who had made Chicago.
You know,
and is capable, and let's forget that he made 9, but he's capable of doing very good musicals, and he's working on another one now, which should be very interesting. But Disney put it out, and with all the anti-Disney stuff in it,
Yeah.
It's very good. There are some minor problems. We won't go into that. But then if you're dealing with the trope of children losing everything, you know.
Right.
I mean, what if a book that would have, like, at random, five kids who somehow gather together and go off and discover that all of the universes in which they live, all of the worlds are destroyed? What kind of a weirdo would write that?
Well, not all.
That's
of
and that's why you used a pseudonym for your book, eh?
Oh yeah.
We have to explain that to the audience.
Actually, that's not why I used a pseudonym for my book.
I'm sorry, but I had to get back
However, I will note that my book, which does follow the five kids whose world is destroyed, it's not marketed to children, nor is it even about really young children. You know, we're talking teenagers
As a YA, would have read it. Although I probably would have read it earlier.
Yes, and I'm not
And I wouldn't necessarily have understood it all.
But
you know, at 8 years old. But I would have reached.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I do encourage that.
And so do I. Kids have the right to reach up. That having been said, when a parent asks me, you know, should I buy this for my child, I definitely ask how old the child is, and I say, you know, if the child is like 13 and up, then I know for a fact that it's appropriate for them because I went to high school and I read high school literature, and all of it is worse.
Yeah.
But
I would say 10 and up.
Yeah, well,
because I believe in that reach.
Absolutely, and I do too. The reason I don't say 10 and up is that I don't know what they're reading in school at the age of 10 because I homeschooled until high school. So I can't say, well, you know, the things they're reading at the same time are perfectly you know, analogous in terms of how dark they are and so on. So because I don't have that base to go on, I know that it's appropriate for high schoolers, but you know, everything else is sort of your mileage may vary.
May I ask, without getting into too much, because you're also going to read for us.
Absolutely.
How it was that you homeschooled for so long? Yeah, and I would say being of a very weird self-upbringing that I'm jealous of that. I hated and loathed school.
Yeah. Well.
And I dropped out.
Oh, did you?
I do not have a high school diploma.
Neither does my dad. Mm. Neither does my dad.
I taught in a continuing.
That's another story. I'm not gonna go. I'm not gonna go there. But he's doing all right now. I homeschooled because my brother, who is 4 years older than me, was the main draw for me to go to school. You know, I was a kid, and I was saying, you know, I don't want to go to school.
My older brother was,
you know, and my parents said,
really taught me.
Yeah, and my parents said, oh, it'll be great. You'll ride the bus with your brother. You know, you'll go there together. You'll come back together. It'll be fine. But then, as luck would have it, in fourth grade, when I was just starting kindergarten, when my brother was in fourth grade, he had like the teacher from hell. Who like yelled at the kids and brought in a newspaper article in which a former student of hers had committed suicide and said, I always knew he would do something stupid like that.
Oh my.
I mean, she was outrageously terrible. And my parents, you know, called the school and the superintendent and whoever. And said, you know, you've got to fire this woman. They said, we can't, you know, seniority, blah, blah, blah. They said, well, you know, we have to transfer our son out of that class and into a better class. And they said, you can't, too many other kids have transferred out of that class already.
Ah.
So we can't let, you know, we can't
class.
Do that. Yeah, no kid. So we can't do that anymore because, you know, the other teachers will be overburdened. So my parents said, well, you know, we can't let him stay in school with this dreadful teacher. So they pulled him out of school, and while they were at it, they sort of had to pull me out. You know, it would have been quite a bait
and
switch.
What state was this in?
This was in Massachusetts. We lived in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Okay, because in New York,
Yeah.
You would have found a truant officer at your door sooner or later.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the school actually threatened to declare us truants.
Okay, yeah.
And my mother got a lot of help from the otherwise very right-wing evangelical pro-homeschooling group. I forget what their name is.
Yeah, but they're afraid you'd be taught, biology or
right, exactly. Like. But they are extremely supportive of homeschooling for any reason. And so for any reason, including all sorts of dreadful reasons. But our reason happened to be a good one, and they were very, very helpful to my parents. And so they helped us navigate the legal intricacies of that, and what it was that we had to do for the state in order to be homeschoolers as opposed to truants and all of that.
How unusual!
And so I really, because of my brother's terrible teacher, I ended up homeschooling almost straight until high school. I say almost because when I was 9, my dad had a business trip that took us to Australia, and we didn't know anybody in Australia, and we were just going to be there for a year, and it turned out to be just 7 months. And so while we were there, they put us in school because how else would we meet kids?
Learn the language,
right?
Because
oh, no kidding,
they speak Oz. They do not speak.
It's true.
Speak English, and neither do they.
For the first month or two, I did not really play with or hang out with the other kids in school. And my teacher said to my parents, at one of these parent teacher conferences, she said, I'm concerned because the kids keep inviting Noah to do things. And he doesn't go with them. And so my mom asked me, why don't you go with them when they invite you to something? And I said, because I don't know what they're asking me to do.
Yeah. Because
it took a long while for me to figure out the different accent and dialect. There's all kinds of slang words not the same.
There was a guy who was trying to run the World Science Fiction Convention, was campaigning for it.
Oh, yeah.
He walked around cons with a koala.
Uh-huh.
Thick leather glove.
Oh, an actual koala. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and he was giving it the eucalyptus keeping people away because...
because they'll scratch you.
They
can be nasty.
His gloves, well, not intentionally, but his gloves were, an inch thick, and their claws were thicker than that.
I bet.
And at any rate, this guy worked for the Australian Broadcast Commission, the IBC.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, so you work for Pacifica. I said, that's right. And he said, do you get a good screw there?
Yep.
Well, that means are you well compensated for your work?
Absolutely.
Jimmy Cagney said it would refer to a prison guard.
Absolutely.
And, so the language is all screwed up. So,
So that's, that's a whole other story.
We've had two Australian program directors here, WBAI.
Really? That's great.
So I used to announce one saying... this is WBAI New York, and the following program is Investigations. And he did not appreciate that.
I wonder why.
I can't imagine. not nice guy, good program director, but no, he didn't care for that.
Okay.
Your story that you want to read could take up to half an hour?
We'll find out.
The thing is, it's 2:20.
Yes, I really ought to read it now, and then we'll find out what we have time for.
I was gonna give you two alternatives.
Mm.
One is to read it now.
Yeah.
We know that you're going to come back for a peculiar take on an interactive reading.
Oh yes, we have to.
Which is a must do.
Oh yeah.
So we have two choices: is that we can just chat and promote your book and take listener calls. And because I'm having a great time chatting, or you can read this piece, and then the show's going to be over.
Well, I don't know if it'll take that long, but
how many
out.
Pages? You told me about 12 pages.
No, that's the
piece.
That's the interactive one. This one's only like 5 pages.
Oh,
I'll read it now. And then
read it
we'll
now.
Have some
Do you
time.
Want a piece of music first? Hello, Lister. Yes, there's somebody behind you.
There's a very strange man.
And he is. I would say there's nothing offensive about my saying you're a very strange man, right?
It's a compliment.
It is, absolutely, because you are, and I thank the wisdoms for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
All right, well, I will read this brief short story. It's called Super Taster.
Okay, and I'm going to see if I can come up with a segue after.
Sure. It was the smell that did it to me. I've always been ultra-sensitive to tastes and smells. I can't stand mint. Have to use kids' toothpastes that are strawberry-flavored or whatever. And I'm not allergic to scents, but perfumes still drive me up the effing wall. The point is that I picked up on the smell literally weeks before anything happened. And I know that sounds impossible, but it's true. I'm not saying I'm psychic. Well, maybe my nose is. Just bear with me, okay? It wasn't too strong the first few days. Cedar smoke, faint but exquisite. Some kind of meat, too. I figured someone was smoking a ham or something. But that smell, it never went away. It stayed in my nose while I slept, and every day it was a little stronger. I told my husband about it, but we checked the news and the police reports and didn't see anything, and he even went out driving to see if he could spot some smoke. I know I was driving him crazy. Well, I did suggest he call the Houghtons, what with that fancy sauna they have all out of cedarwood. But he didn't in the end, he just drove by and looked for himself, and everything was fine. But my nose wouldn't quit. The smoke smell was getting so strong I could barely taste my food, and that other smell along with it. I knew what it was by then. A human being, an effing human being, roasting. Yes, that's when I called 911. I felt like an idiot because Joe couldn't smell a thing, but I felt I had to call. So they came out and didn't find anything and looked at me like I was some kind of hysterical housewife, and I almost yelled at them that it was a long weekend and they shouldn't look at me like that. I'm a college professor, for Christ's sake. I have plenty to keep me occupied without inventing mysterious smells to trouble them with. Well, I thought I was going crazy. And the thing is, I love the smell of meat smoking. I still did, even after days of it. But now I was disgusted with myself, too, because it's shameful to enjoy the smell of a person burning, to realize that that smell is making you hungry. And I thought, well, if it's all in my head and no one else can smell it, is it still wrong for me to be salivating? I knew I ought to go see a neurologist. Phantom smells could be a sign of a tumor or something. Everyone's afraid of cancer nowadays, even if they try not to think about it. But I didn't want to be given those choices yet. Chemo or radiation or surgery, maybe all of the above, or else just giving up and letting myself die without having to go through all of that horrendous radiation stuff for nothing. I've always thought I might go the hospice route if it came down to it, so what difference would an early diagnosis make? Besides, I could live with a smell. My dinner might taste like human, even when it was hake and asparagus, but at least it still tasted good. I had to admit, though, that it was affecting my teaching. Even in the middle of class, I was sniffing and getting distracted and, yes, salivating. So I finally weakened and made an appointment for yesterday with a neurologist. I was lucky they'd had a cancellation. They did all these tests. I'll get the full results later, but I doubt they'll find anything because naturally it's gone now. It was when I got home that I saw the smoke wafting over from the Houghton's place. Oddly enough, I didn't even notice the smell then. I just drove right over like I was in a dream, and there was the sauna up in flames. It had partially collapsed, but Ed Houghton was halfway out the door with his head bashed in. I think he'd regained consciousness right as the building was coming down, but whoever had it in for him stuck around and gave him a whack when he crawled out. Anyway, I didn't think. I just grabbed these gardening gloves that were in the back seat, and I ran to pull him out. I don't think I believed he was still alive. It just seemed like the right thing to do. No, I didn't wonder about who'd murdered him. I'm telling you, it was just like a dream. I pulled him out, and you could see that it was a lost cause. I mean, you've seen the photos. But that was when the scent hit me again, the one that had been haunting me for weeks and making my mouth water, and I looked down at his burned-up legs, and I'm telling you, the meat was coming right off the bone. I don't know how long he'd been in there, but his lower half was well done. So I'm not going to pretend it was the right thing to do, but I just did it. I grabbed his right calf, and it came away just like that, and I peeled the burnt skin off and blew a little and took a bite. And I'm sorry, but it was delicious. It was everything I'd imagined all those weeks, the taste of Ed Houghton and the smell of the cedar burning. It was magical. And then the firefighters showed up and the police, and I'll admit, it sounds absolutely insane. It probably makes sense to lock me up. But I didn't kill anybody, so it would be a mistake to charge me with murder. There's still jail time for cannibalism, right? Or for impeding a police investigation or whatever. The thing is, I couldn't have killed him. Those tests at the hospital lasted forever. I'm sorry I can't be more helpful about the whole murder thing. It's weird to have finally woken up out of this weeks-long daze and to have been the first person to find the body, and all I can really tell you about is how Ed tasted. Which is really effing good.
Here is the news. According to the latest world population survey, figures have reached danger point, my god. London, 15,075,000. New York, 80 million. Paris, 50 million and 30. China, 1,000 million. Police and spa nuts.
My studies include exophagy. I formed my own society to crush the power of fecundity. The world will overpopulate unless you claim infertility. So who will buy a drink for me, your messiah? We are not your friends. We don't give a damn for what you're saying. We're here to live our lives. I propose to give the pill charge to those that feel that they are not invertible. The crops are few, the cattle gone. There's only one way to linger on. So who will buy a drink for me, your messiah? We are not your friends. We don't give a damn for what you're saying. We're here to live our lives.
These are your orders. Anyone found guilty of consuming more than their allotted amount of air will be slaughtered and cremated.
I prepared a document legalizing mass abortion. We will turn a blind eye to infanticide. We are not your friends. We don't give a damn for what you're saying. We're here to live our lives. You don't seem to hear me clear. Do I talk above your sphere? Let me explain my project, dear. Show you how I'll save the world, or let it die within the year. Why do you look that way at me, your messiah? We are not your friends. Don't give a damn for what you're saying. We're here to live our lives. We are hungry men. We don't give a damn for what you're saying. We're here to eat you.
David Bowie, people. People don't figure. I was teasing Lister and Noah, and as to trying to give them clues, as saying, "Well, his son makes movies." Now it would have been a giveaway if I had said that his first movie was Moon, and you wouldn't have known.
Not
that?
For me. I live under a rock.
Okay, his first two movies are brilliant, Moon and. Oh, what's the one with Jake Gyllenhaal or Gyllenhaal, in which he has to relive saving a train over and over and over and over until he accomplishes it. Small budget movies, really top-notch movies. And so what happens when a person makes these really brilliant small budget films? They put them at the helm of huge CGI spectacular. So last week, Warcraft.
Right.
But, you know, with that same movie maker plucked out of independent filmmaking at the head of a giant film, which has gotten nothing but bad reviews and is making money hand over fist.
Yep.
But his father, who encouraged his artistic talents and all that, whose real name was Jones David, I don't remember what, David Bowie.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why Duncan Jones, he never capitalized, like the horror writer Joe Hill, whose father is Stephen King. Joe Hill didn't reveal himself as the son of Stephen King until after he had bestsellers and all these awards for great horror writing.
Right.
You have to admire that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind people using their celebrity to get their foot in the door.
Yeah.
But then after that, they have to perform.
Sure.
But anyhow, that was the unknown David Bowie.
Very nice. 19... We are here to eat you.
Yeah, we are hungry men. Mm-hmm. The punchline, we are there are about three or four wonderful songs on that album, which is actually a compilation of his earliest stuff called the DRAM Anthology, D-E-R-A-M, which was the label that Bowie did his earliest work for. And, you know, 1966, this is among his earliest work.
Well, I will reassure your listeners that there's only a little bit of cannibalism in Silent Hall.
Okay. What, one meal? Just one meal. It's like in Rocky Horror Show. There's only
frankly,
one meal.
I don't know if it even counts as cannibalism.
Meatloaf for dinner, you know.
I don't know if it counts as cannibalism either. But it's off screen in the past.
A little closer to the mic, please.
Yes.
I'm happy with your being comfortable, but you're also welcome to pull the mic closer to you.
Oh, well, that works too.
Yes, it does.
And
during the reading, I should have warned you. Don't talk. Don't say a P into the microphone because it will pop. Exactly. And that happened a couple of times. It's better to talk into the mic and
to the side
exactly.
Like this.
That, you got it. Yeah. That's
what I really ought to have done to begin with is to turn the mic sideways and then
exactly.
I can lean forward
and
like this.
It was my fault for not having said that.
Oh, well, what can you do?
Because we were chatting too much, having too much of
yes,
a fun
and you know,
time.
The plan is for me to come back in a few months. And,
it is.
And we will read a wonderful interactive story, hopefully with some
callers.
When
we say we, we're talking about you, too.
Oh, yes.
But we should reintroduce the show. First of all, this is Hour of the Wolf.
Yes.
My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction and fantasy and related fields of endeavor. With me, Noda Beta Haron.
Beta Haron. Yes,
do
indeed.
It, do it
very good.
Do it proper.
Noah Beit Aharon.
I never get those Semitic sounds correct.
That's all right.
Not when they're
everybody
Jewish
has a different
and not
one.
When they're my friend Saladin Ahmed.
Oh, yes.
I think I did it right for the first time ever because
quite
I
possible.
Wasn't trying. And Barbara Nimri Aziz here of WBAI.
But
she would say, no. When you get to the H, aspirate it. Don't, you're going... And I say,
right,
no,
right.
I'm Jewish. You go, huh.
Yeah.
I'm a German Jew. And she's going, no. It's the same thing, but don't go hard on the throat. Just let the air through without...
The German R is very much the Sephardic Reish.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, before our last name was Beit Aharon, it was the German Aronsheim, which means the exact same
now,
thing,
see,
the House of Aaron.
That
and then
I
my grandfather translated it when he made Aliyah. But you know, even within Hebrew speakers, there's regional accents and accents from different countries. And if you spoke to some people, they would roll their resh.
and if you at home want to roll your resh,
call me,
please do that in private.
Yeah, they would call me Noah Beit Aharon. You know, and it would, it would sound very beautiful,
very Scottish,
but that's not how I say it.
Actually, it's you know, it's like, you know, you should be there should be a bagpipe around when somebody says that. But they're all Semitic languages.
Yes.
And this is something that people fail to understand.
Is that they're
being a Semite means having a certain root in your language.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what it means.
I vote for Islamophobia to be rebranded as anti-Semitism.
Yes, it is.
because we're all Semites, and it's for whatever reason, people who are totally comfortable with Islamophobia are often not comfortable with anti-Semitism for some reason.
And the funny thing is that I feel kindred with so many of my fellow Semites.
Absolutely.
Because being a German Jew... you know, this feels, today with the elections going on, it feels, and what goes on in Orlando and all this feels like Weimar Germany.
Yeah, it can sometimes.
It really does in so many ways. Only now, instead of one branch of the Semites, it's now the other branch.
Yep.
But it's the same darned thing, and I wish people would wake up to that. Mm.
Well, I haven't heard of any anti-Ethiopian stuff going on, but that's a third branch
because
of the Semites.
Because the food is too good.
Well,
we have to ask Habte about that. Habte Selassie, when is he on the air now? He used to
Saturday.
Well, he used to precede me when I was on the air Saturday mornings. I was on 5 to 7. I think he's on now 3 to 5. Yeah. Yeah, great show, everybody. And Ian is on Mondays. Yeah, so we have two shows of Ethiopia. Well, Ian's a little more Jamaican.
Ethiopian music or Ethiopian
culture?
Oh, cool.
Very
nice.
Yeah, all that good stuff. Okay, I probably shouldn't do this, but I'm really curious.
Oh, there's a caller.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, at least, could you pronounce his last name again, please?
I'll let him do that.
Yeah, please, Noah.
My last name is Beit Aharon, but if you are looking to buy my book, I am published under N.S. Dolkart, D-O-L-K-A-R-T.
As a lover of names and ethnicities, may I ask if it's not objectionable what the derivation of Beit Aharon is?
You weren't listening.
Yes,
I was.
It's
House of David.
House of Aaron.
House of Aaron.
Aaron, the brother of Moses in the Bible. So it brands me and my family as Kohens. In fact, we are from the priestly tribe.
Kohens or Kohanes?
Well, Kohanim, really, but
Kohanim, yes. Levites to the center.
Yes.
To the center.
I did not. I only went to Hebrew school for one whole year. I loathed it, and my father forgave me.
Well, that's fair enough.
By the way, Noah,
yes.
If I may call you that,
sure.
At least your protagonist did not eat a census taker with fava beans and a bottle of Chianti.
That is true.
Now, I must ask you a question. By the way, James, what would have been just as appropriate, I mean, I loved what you played, but what would have been a perfectly appropriate would have been either Sweeney Todd or the Ballad of Alfred Packer.
Yes, but the difference, I don't know the ballad, I know about Alfred Packer, I don't know the song, but Have a Little Priest from Sweeney Todd is 7.5 minutes long,
and this was
2.5 minutes long,
decision. I think you've actually played Alfred Packer on one of your previous shows.
I'm not familiar
with the song.
The Colorado
Cannibal, who when
I know who he is, and we don't have the time.
No, but I want to get to something that you discussed, and that's orphan trope.
Oh yeah.
I'm curious as to what your guest thought of the recently
Jungle Book. You're talking to him.
Yes, Noah.
Here
what
I
do
am.
You think of the recent Jungle Book, which I actually think is almost the perfect orphan trope movie?
Yeah. The bad news is I haven't seen it. And the good news is that that's because I have two adorable children under the age of 4.
Have you seen
I haven't seen a movie in ages.
Let me ask
nor
you,
have I finished a book, unfortunately.
Have,
besides the one I wrote.
Stop popping your piece. But
no, I mean I haven't finished reading once.
No, my question is, have you ever seen... Everybody talks about the original, like the Disney is the original. There's the version with Sabu.
1940.
1940. Great. Wonderful, wonderful movie.
And, it, you know, it's done actually...
And it has something to do with Kipling, which the other one does not.
Wow. Yeah, well, I must say this.
The other two do not.
The way that that movie is done, it's done as, a, it's as an old man telling these young people this story of Mowgli and how he got lost in the jungle and the whole thing. And the most poignant part is when Sabu has been cast out by both the jungle and the man.
Sabu's the actor who played Mowgli.
Right. And he said, I belong to no one. I belong to no group. The jungle has cast me out, and so has the man pack. Very, very sad.
It's a beautifully done film.
Oh, it is,
and, I have now there can be nothing wrong with the new one because it has Scarlett Johansson's voice in it. But outside of that,
well, you know, the other movie, of course, Sabu did this great Thief of Baghdad, also 1940. Huh. Now, one other question. You mentioned fairy tale movies. I want to recommend something to both of you.
Sure.
James may have seen this. A movie came out in 2015, which I recently caught at the International Film Center, called Tale of Tales. What this is, it is three stories taken from a 1632 Neapolitan compilation called Le Conto di Licunti.
Yeah, it was reviewed on this program.
It was?
Yes, it was.
I missed it. What did Dan say about it? I'm curious. Liked it.
He did not. He found a lot of flaws in it.
Well,
it is an interesting film, and it is in keeping with our theme of the fantastic for the morning, but I'd rather stick to Noah's writing.
Well, right. I can tell you a little bit about my writing if you'd like.
Yes, go ahead.
So, you know, what I've done with the Orphan Tale is that my characters are set forth as sort of... You know, we can call them wandering Jews, even though they're not Jewish, and Judaism doesn't exist in my mythos. Nonetheless, they're left as people without a homeland, wandering around, identifiable by everyone, and hated by most. And so for that, you know, the orphan trope was necessary. And so they have to leave their entire homeland behind, and they can never go back.
tell us a little more of the précis of the book, Noah.
All right. Well, let me see.
Are all from different backgrounds.
Yes.
Do not
know each other. So we have five teenagers who all end up on the same fishing boat off of their island for totally different reasons, and none of them know each other except for one who's vaguely acquainted with another, but doesn't really know him personally, and they've all ended up on this boat for different reasons, but they end up on the last boat off of their island before the patron goddess's festival, and they reach the continent, and the next day they learn that the island has been struck by some kind of a divine plague, and everybody on the island is dead, except perhaps for the king of the island, and so they don't know whether that's a punishment for the king, a punishment for the people, a punishment for the people, but the king is okay, a punishment just for the king, and the people are collateral damage, and they don't know who did the punishing. They don't know if their patron goddess got mad at them for some reason, or if perhaps the patron goddess was defeated by one of her enemies. And so they're left just sort of to wonder about this terrible divine plague that has taken away everything that they thought they would have in life.
Is this set in a world like us or an alternate Earth?
Oh, it's definitely an alternate.
It's a secondary world.
Absolutely. It's a sword and sorcery sort of world. But
I love it already.
Well, the inspiration for it was actually our very own Bible. Because what I see when I read
an older Testament version, I would say.
Yes. Well, I only read snippets of the New Testament in college.
This caller Robert calls me James, but it's not the James version.
No. But when I read various parts of the Tanakh, not just the Torah, when I read for those who are not Jewish who are listening in, I'm talking about the Hebrew Bible here, the five books of Moses, the prophets, the writings. When you read throughout much of those, you get some very distinct impressions. One is that there are multiple gods in the world, and ours is only the most powerful, right? So, for example, when God is sending Moses off to tell Pharaoh to let the people go, God basically says, "I'm going to send you off to Pharaoh. You tell him to let the people go. I'm going to harden his heart so that he says no, and that'll give me the greatest opportunity to stomp on the Egyptian people and their gods.
That is very specifically,
right?
Their gods.
And their gods, right? I'm going to punish and judge their gods.
This is always in the Passover telling.
Absolutely.
That there's this definite heathen or pagan background in there, because, yes, that a band of evil angels is set upon the earth, and the god or god, or rather by name, mm-hmm. As is used in the ceremony,
yes.
Under proper circumstances,
yes.
will destroy the other gods.
Absolutely.
And I've always noticed that, and since you're supposed to ask questions during Seders, right?
Yeah.
I always stop there, and I ask, you know, whether it be my own house or somebody else's house, first and second Seder,
yeah.
I always say, will somebody explain this to me? And nobody will. The closest I've come is that we have a friend who's a Jesuit who is at our Seder, and he explains.
One last question, Noah.
Sure.
Is this, you have a secondary world, as Tolkien described such places. Do you have a world-building situation? Do we have, for example, maybe creation myths, or maybe music, or culture?
He has fabulous world-building. May I answer that question?
Oh, have you read it? Excellent.
Yes,
what? Well, I know I sent it to you, but I have friends
I send things to. I will admit I did not read the whole thing virtual cover. But I am about halfway through it, as I'm also through something else at the same time
that
I have to do a blurb for.
you got to prioritize.
And that one has a deadline of a week from now.
Are there maps?
There are no maps.
I will say that...
I mean, you could draw a map.
In future iterations, and I wouldn't be surprised to find that there will be some.
Ooh.
Could be.
Could be. Some people have described
people
this book as being, I would say it's better than this, but some people have compared it to Robert Jordan.
I've heard that too. I again, because I live under a rock, I haven't read Robert Jordan.
Too many pages.
May I
my
really...
reputation and
I would give you a very good recommendation about Robert Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Don't. No, that's not fair. Robert Jordan, I read his first book. It was very entertaining. I immediately picked up the second book in the Wheel of Time, and it was also somewhat entertaining. And the third book,
I realized. Yeah.
It was the same book over and over and over.
I quit after 700 pages of second book, and we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but basically, no.
It's about where I gave up.
I lap up world building. When I read a fantasy, a high epic like what you obviously have here, a high epic, I want to hear songs. I want to hear poets. I want to hear bards. I want to hear people talking. You know, I want to see, for example, if they sit around the fire at night. Hey, you know, tell me that old story that your grandmother used to tell.
There's definitely a lot of old stories, but I do some fun things with world building that probably haven't seen much in fantasy. I have one of my favorite things to. I have a couple of screeds that people read. There's a screed that may as well be a medieval screed against the Jews, but it's directed at the half dragon people, And the other thing that I have always enjoyed writing for some reason...
Mixing the blood with the food, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not another blood libel.
Oh, there's a blood libel
yes.
in there.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Because, I mean, obviously, half-dragon people must just love devouring
just
human
like the
babies.
Miller's daughter. That's an ancient...
Yeah. So...
you would know that, Robert, because Steel Eyes spanned a diversion.
So the other...
Which one
the
are we
other,
talking about? The Miller's daughter? Oh, the Jew's daughter.
It has different names under the child ballad.
Yes,
rules.
Little Sir Hugh. Yes.
Little Sir Hugh is another version of it. Yeah.
So the other thing that I really enjoy writing is I write my world has wizardry is no more, or at least academic wizardry is no more. there was an academic wizardry that the gods decided had gone too far and decided to put an end to.
Because recently there have been way too many wizard schools.
Right. Well, so there are no more wizard schools. All the wizard schools have been destroyed.
So
my favorite wizard school is the Unseen Academicals.
so there's this legacy of academic wizardry that is no more. And so the main characters, while rescuing scrolls, you know, in an attempt to learn something about the half dragon people's origins, because the guy is obsessed with his culture that he knows very little about, they come across one of these scrolls of academic wizardry, and it's of course written entirely in passive voice. In dry academic writing, and it starts out with an abstract that they can't decipher for the life of them, and then they just sort of throw it aside and pick up the next scroll.
So, very last quick question, because I know Jim's running up against time.
Sure.
Right.
Could you have a website, and could you spell your last name, please, just for us?
Me?
Yes.
Sure, although my website is under my pen name, which is really my wife's maiden name.
Okay.
Oh, I was going to ask where that
came
from.
Yeah, so NS are my first two initials, and Dolkart is my wife's maiden name.
D-O-L-K-A-R-T.
You did say NS, like Nancy Simpson?
Yes, like Nancy Simpson.
NS Dolkart.
Absolutely.
And your website is what? NSDolkart.
NSDolkart.wordpress.com, or if you go to
NSDolkart.com,
that'll
bring you to the right place.
That'll
keep up the good work. It sounds spiffy to the nth degree.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Take care. To the answer to the second question, BEIT-AHARON.
I
did that without looking.
Yeah. And in Hebrew, I spell it without a vav.
Oh, okay. As a vav.
I spell it biblically, as I do my my first name. Noach is just Nunchet and no vav. And I have had Israelis be very confused at me.
As
and I
a
tell
vav,
them, well,
so
that's
below.
The way it is in the Bible, and that's the way I spell it.
It would be. I guess it's the printing. You know, I don't know. My Hebrew school.
Yeah, modern Hebrew does all kinds of interesting things.
Well, you see, I come from a Reformed Jew background.
Oh, yeah.
And so very liberal and very modern. Well, would that be? 17th, 18th century Reformed?
When did the reform movement start? I want to say 18th century, but I could be wrong.
That sounds right. You know, late medieval or just post medieval Germany.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Post medieval Germany. My father being from Nuremberg, and being Jews in Nuremberg, that's why I'm first generation American.
Yes,
so it was the 30s, gang. It was anyway.
Yeah,
and we're there again, but.
Yep.
having said that, so the book, again, is from Angry Robot Books. You know, I've never figured out why it's so important to mention the publisher, but we always do it. Writers always do it. I guess it's thank you.
And for some publishers, especially Angry Robot, for some publishers, they really have their own following. The big five generally don't because they
but then with
the
big five
they're so big
you don't but you know Tor you, Books is
exactly.
part of Macmillan you wouldn't
exactly.
know that's a Macmillan book
right so Angry Robot
you know it's like
it's,
Son of Hartwell or Daughter
right.
of Hartwell
exactly so because Angry Robot is small and lean and mean
They have their own dedicated angry robot followers. So I've never followed them, but I've also never picked up
an angry robot book that I didn't enjoy.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? I got a Goodreads review recently from a fellow who said, you know, I picked this up because the first chapters really drew me in, even though I have never ever enjoyed an angry robot book. I still bought it at the bookstore. And you know, he ended up not particularly enjoying mine, but saying that it was fine. But you know what? He bought the book, so kudos to him. Thank you very much, whoever you are out there.
You got your shekel. Okay, so.
But you know what? They always tell you as a writer, especially when you want to submit to agents, to editors, to whoever, you know, make sure that your first five pages are the best five pages. Make sure your first sentence is the best sentence. Make sure your first chapter is the best chapter. And so, you know what? If a guy picked up an angry robot book knowing that he had never enjoyed an angry robot book before and that he'd probably tried several to have such an opinion, and he read the first two chapters of my book and still decided to buy it.
And let us say, by the way, although we're using the male pronoun, the book is very gender-friendly.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
That's important to say.
As are the gods. There is a... speaking of world-building, that my... I'm very careful to be, as with our real world, there are lots of theories about what's going on in the heavens, and nobody really knows the answers. And one of the theories that one of my characters brings up is that despite the fact that you've spent like three quarters of the book already talking about gods as he's and she's and whatever, that in fact the gods are genderless and they just they go with what humans have decided for them because they like human worship and they think that it'll be easier for humans to worship them if they are more relatable. so they go by genders just for humans' benefits.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. And so far, I've enjoyed the book. Let's put it this way. I am not compelled now to have to finish it, but I have every intention of doing so because it is a lot of fun. And I do like immersive fantasy. There are times in my life, and this has in many ways been one of those times in my life, where I need something where I can just go somewhere.
Yeah.
David Hartwell, the late David Hartwell, we mentioned earlier, oh no, that was off air, Terry Pratchett. But Terry Pratchett is a person, David Hartwell said, it is a proven scientific fact that reading Terry Pratchett will balance your cholesterol level. And I have to say...
You know, they really should have done a longitudinal study on that. They still can.
There's still time.
They can do a good, like, double-blind longitudinal study on, let's say, 50,000 people, forcing 25,000 of them to read Terry Pratchett and seeing if it makes a difference.
Yes, yeah. I think that's a wonderful idea.
None of this self-selecting stuff. I mean, you can't have already read Terry Pratchett and loved him. You have to choose people, none of whom have read him, and force
and
some of them to read him,
read
and some not to read him.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. But for listeners of mine, you are forced to read Terry Pratchett, and you are forced to read Silent Hall by N.S. Dolkart.
Thank you very much.
And he will be back in the spring, I believe.
Oh, and I ought to say, because I almost forgot, and I have 2 minutes left.
You have
I ought to
that
say
because
that
that's the theme music
oh,
in the background
yes.
you're hearing.
Okay, well, this very night at 7 p.m.
Thursday.
In
Montclair, New Jersey.
In Montclair, New Jersey, at Watchung Booksellers, I will be reading a little bit from Silent Hall and doing a Q&A and autographing books and hanging out and chatting with people if they feel like chatting with me.
So that's what you have to do, is you have to not go online and buy the book by N.S. Dolkart. You have to go and meet Noah at the bookstore. Buy it there and get it all.
Absolutely. Watchung Booksellers, 7 p.m. today, Thursday.
There's an event page on Facebook.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you for being here. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. This is amazing.
Yeah. Okay, and we're going to explain the interactive nature of where we're going.
Yes,
but all we have to say to listeners is, stay tuned. It's going to be fun. It'll be experimental radio and literature all at the same time. Experimental audiobook, I think is a good way to put it.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Speaking of audiobooks, I have not yet made an announcement, but one day I will. If anybody goes to Amazon.com or Audible.com, just look up Chatting Science Fiction. You might be surprised at what you find. In the meantime, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week, Wednesday morning, Thursday morning, at sometime at 1:30 with guest Daniel M. Brom. And the sign-off is, please, people, be good to each other. You deserve it. We deserve it. That's all there is to it. Good day. And take care. Stay tuned for Burn Baby, Burn Clappers. I didn't leave you any time. The song is about over. I'm out of here. Thank you. Thank you, Noah. That's why you're supposed to get off the air 5 minutes beforehand.
When I leave, you're going to remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. But the black for the brother, and I'm no lover of this flag. Like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. A nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest. And watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Miami, do or die, best style, never ran, never will.
Hotel Brownsville. Boogie down South Bronx. Yeah. My man Joey to jail and not a
easy but harder than you knew. You don't want to stick your head out the window, which could be cut off or be sold. You're stealing all the gold. You're rich, you drink them with your pensions, you be low. You come to school me, but we fight harder than you knew. You don't want to stick your head out the window, we could be cut off or be sold. You're stealing all the gold. Keep running with the money you steal. Don't get caught, you better not slow down. Keep running with the money you steal. So we find it hard to get along. Keep running with the money you steal. Don't get caught, you better not slow down. Keep running with the money you steal. So we find it hard to get along. Oh.
You think I saw? I know so. Tenastlin. Dana Ixabir Yimasgan. Sata Amasagana.
This is it. Originally. Thou shalt not steal, said the Almighty. The King of Kings is he, who rules eternally.
Honor and majesty. Before him, a false witness shall not be unpunished, saith the Lord.
To eat from thine own vineyard is sweet to the soul,
but to steal from thy brethren is bitter to the belly.
Behold, how good and how pleasant it is. Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity.
What a great day it will be when God's people shall be free.
There shall be a time of eternal day.
Please lead us to that land, Lord. That is far away.
Our open wide.
In thee, O Lord, we will abide. From my tree of version, that bringeth forth fruit in its season. Sata Amatigana, originally. Love ye one to another. God loves us all. Love me and I love you. God will hear us when we call. While rolling down this righteous track, we won't be turning back, oh no. Like I said, originally, this is it. Sata Amatigana. Gize one dim. Dainai Xavier, Yimasgan, Gurmawi.